I would say pretty much straight through the Bible. If you remember last week, we were talking about the relationship between David and Jonathan. And this week, we're continuing. We're getting into what your books say, really, David and Saul's relationship, which is kind of rocky. We're going to start with 1 Samuel chapter 24. In that, we're going to, just right at the beginning, there's a lot in these two chapters that it goes over. So we're gonna miss some things, but we are going to read 1 Samuel 24 for a little while, and then we're going to jump to 1 Samuel 26. And what I've hinted towards this, not hinted, I've said this many, many times as we've been reading about Saul and David, is one of the, to me, one of the most admirable things about David, one of the traits that I desire for myself, because it's what I struggle with the most, is patience. And over these two stories, in my opinion, these are the two best stories of David that exemplify that. Because we reflect, David already knows he's the next king, doesn't he? He's already been anointed, and really he's just waiting for his time to come. And so we have David who knows, Saul who understands and knows, and says Saul was fearful because he saw that God was now no longer with him. He was now with David. So he's scared, right? It makes sense. He's separated now. Since God's no longer with him. In fact, God sends upon this darkness upon him that makes him desire to kill David. Really act in ways that are completely separate from anything God did. And so out of that comes fear. And again, I want us to put ourselves in his shoes a little bit. By that, I mean, who gets scared because they don't know God's timing? I do. Who gets nervous when things aren't necessarily going well? I do. Who gets nervous about the end times or death or all these things that typically make people anxious? And what Saul's revealing in this case is it's human nature. He doesn't know what's going on anymore. He is no longer, God's no longer communicating with him. When God's communicating, when he was communicating with him, he kind of knew what was going on. He was appointed king. God laid out these things. And all these things come to pass. And so he's got these assurances, if you will, or this understanding of what's to come. And then that gets taken away. It's probably a scary thing, right? I remember when I was, wasn't long ago, it's been a quick, however many years, 7 years since I graduated, but in high school I thought I was invincible. College, thought I was invincible. Then you get married and you have kids and you think, better not jump off this rock. I better not, like, you start to think about things a little bit more. Then this understanding that, hey, death's to come. And Saul's grappling with this, I think. He's grappling with the fact that he knows his lineage will not sit on the throne. He's grappling with the fact that there's already been someone appointed in his place while he's still alive. He's grappling with all these things. And so, again, when I ask us to put ourselves in other people's shoes, it's not to justify, it's to relate. Because at the end of the day, are Saul's actions justifiable? No, they're not justifiable. Are they relatable? Yes. What that means is probably our actions that we take when we get into these places, when we get into this worry, are also not justifiable. But there is a peace that comes with being in tune with God. I'm not saying that you're going to know how long you live. I'm not saying that you're going to know all these things or see into the future. What I am saying is that you can see past death. There's peace in that. You can see into eternity. You can have comfort and confidence in what's going to happen after you die. So we're going to start in 1 Samuel 24. Again, these are stories that I greatly admire, just the patience that's exemplified through David after. And he already knows he's the next one in line. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of Engedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goat's rocks. And when he came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Then David arose and stealthily cut off the corner of Saul's robe. And afterwards, David's heart struck him because he had cut off the corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed." So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. His men say, "Hey, this is the day. He's pursuing you in every stretch of the human mind." What would have been a justifiable action? To kill him. And then after that, guess who killed Saul in ancient days, who was looked on with grandeur because they sing songs about David and how he kills the 10,000s? Who would be next in line? David would have a pretty good case, right? And God has also anointed David. So everything's pointing into, hey, he's just been delivered into your hands. And in my head, I'd have been like, thanks, God. Like, this, now's the time to go. Well, what does David say? "This is God's anointed. I'll wait." A guy who's not living in luxury, he's hiding in the wilderness, which, who just complained about that for years and years and years, God's people wandering the wilderness. This is David in the wilderness, hiding from Saul because he knows he's trying to kill him.
3,000 men.
Like, it's not a passive attempt. It's not a one, hey, if you find them, look, let me know. It's, hey, they're on hot pursuit. They know the area he's in and obviously are right there with 3,000 men. And David just passes. And passes with 3,000 men sitting outside the cave. And he says, hey, it's not my job to reach out my hand to God's anointing. I'm going to let God take it in his time, but I'm not going to stretch. That's not how I'm going to start my rule. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord king." And Saul looked behind him. David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, Why do you listen to the words of men who say, Behold, David seeks your harm. Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hand. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you. And see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. As soon as David finished speaking these words, Saul said, Is this your voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you have dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me therefore by the Lord that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house. And David swore this to Saul, and Saul went home. But David and his men went up to the stronghold. We are going to skip chapter 25. It's a great story. I'd love to get into that, but to keep everything congruent, we're going to go to chapter 26. There's been several instances where Saul has said that he's no longer going to pursue David. And every time he comes back, even after David again, he walks out of the cave and he says, Hey, look what I got. The Lord delivered you into my hand and I did nothing. Why would you pursue me in the case and the reasoning of treason, saying that people are telling you that I'm pursuing your life. And here I had it in my hands and I'm going to do nothing. And then one chapter later, then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hachilah, which is on the east of Jeshimon? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hachilah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw Saul came out after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, who will go down with me into the camp of Saul? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment, with a spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice. But David said to Abishai, Do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless. And David said, as the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him. Or his day will come to die, or he will go down into the battle and perish. Three options there, right? David said, hey, I don't know what's going to happen, but eventually his day will come. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but take now the spear that is at his head in the jar of water and let us go. So David took the spear in the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because as a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen. Then David went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, will you not answer Abner? Then Abner answered, who are you? Who calls to the king? And David said to Abner, are you not a man who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? So one of the people came in to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die, because you have not kept watch over your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is in the jar of water that was at his head. Saul recognized David's voice and said, is this your voice, my son David? And David said, it is my voice, my lord, O king. And he said, why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now therefore, let my lord, the king, hear the words of the servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now therefore, let not my blood fall on earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like this one who hunts a partridge in the mountains. Then Saul said, I have sinned, return my son David. For I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes. This day, behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake. And David answered and said, here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may the life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation. Then Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. David, next scene, please. This final week's review. And then after that, I don't know, because I don't have the next book. Y'all might have seen me but then we have the fall of Saul, and then we have a long, not so pretty introduction to the kingdom for David. But I want to point out a couple things. I know at the beginning I pointed out David's patience, and God delivers him into his hand twice, and he refuses to stretch out his hand against God's anointed. I want us to think of the heart in that. Because it's not necessarily, we don't have the extremes today. But who's wished ill will on a neighbor? Probably most of us, right? Frustrated to a point. And I think we can, this kind of hit home for me, because I'm competitive and a lot of different things. Not all of which are good. But David has no ill intent nor ill wish. That's a mindset I hope all of us can reach. No matter what people are doing, this is the love your enemies line, right? This is exemplifying what we're reading in the Sermon on the Mount. This is going above and beyond. This Saul seeking to kill David, and he's got a chance to strike back, justifiable by all of Israel, justifiable by the time period that they lived in, justifiable by probably us sitting here today. And the choice he makes is to let God take care of it through God's means. Now, how many of y'all have explained how easy it would it have been in David's situation? His own men are saying, hey, God's delivered him into your hand. Do as it seems fit. How many of y'all are going, hey, this is God's will, right? How often do we like to do that in our lives? Hey, this is God's will for me to take this next step. Hey, this is God's will. The heart of David in this moment blows me away. Genuinely. Because he had everything, the being anointed by God. God put, it even says outside of his people saying, God delivered him into his hands. So he's got all this stacked up telling him to do something. And what's David's heart do? God take care. That is, even sitting here, hard for me to wrap my head around. Probably hard for some of y'all to wrap your head around. But what I want to point out is this action, and when Saul dies, we'll see it shortly, when Saul dies, he's bent over on a spear, but I don't know if we'll see it shortly. I don't know what the next book says. But when Saul dies, Saul asks a young man to kill him. And he does. And what happens to that young man? David kills him. He says, hey, you're one of God's people. Nobody's going to stretch out their hand against God's anointed. And what I want us to hopefully process through and chew on, probably throughout the week, probably throughout the rest of your lives, is there's probably opportunities in y'all's life where you can justifiably harm or hinder somebody. Right? Whether it's business, financial, whatever the case may be. It's kind of hard just to sit there and take it. Understanding that you're God's anointed, understanding all these things that David had the understanding of, understanding that he would go into a kingdom and a palace and live as a ruler with luxury, giving all that up to let God's time play. See, I think oftentimes, I'm going to be careful because people get this statement mixed up. We're not the judge. Does that mean you're not supposed to point out wrong? If a brother's living in sin, if a sister's living in sin, it's still your job to point it out, right? We're supposed to be a support system. But we are not the judge. Anytime you get in the mindset of doing things to prevent other people from going somewhere or to hold somebody down in whatever regard, what are you doing? You're taking 5 steps back. Because God's saying, hey, I want you to be here. And you're like, oh, well, let me just keep my foot right here so I make sure that they don't go anywhere. And God's saying, hey, no, I want you here. And you're like, well, but, you know, you're the one that delivered them into my hands. You're the one who put their future, their whatever the case may be, in my hands. I kind of want to squash them. I think one of the most attractive things about Christian wives, how they should live and should lead, is they should be bolstering other people up. It was never meant to be a pedestal. It was never meant to be, I mean, we're called to be lowly, right? Wash feet, be a servant. We're not called to be on this pedestal where people are like, hey, that guy's got it figured out. We're called to wash feet. And so when we start to put ourselves up on that and think that we're more than we are, we start to miss everything. When I was in high school, I think this was something, was it Coulter Brad, said that you're supposed to, a good player doesn't make Colt McCoy. I don't know if any of y'all know. He used to be the quarterback of the Texas Longhorns, and then he played about 10, 11 years in the NFL. Said, a good player doesn't make themselves better. A good player makes their whole team better. What does a good player want? To win. It's not trying to hold other people back or look like a star. It blows people away. Homer will ask, and it makes me laugh. People at my office will ask, and they don't believe me, and they're never going to get a no for sure, because I'm not ever going to be in this position. But they'll ask me, would you rather be paid $100 million and be on a team that just absolutely is terrible, loses every game? Or would you rather make $100,000 and be on a team that wins? Like, $100,000 and win. They're like, no, you wouldn't. I'm like, no, I would, for sure. That's the mindset that we need to get into for everybody here. For all the people that you come into contact. I think we see it portrayed well in Jonah's story. God is calling a people to follow him. And what's Jonah playing the part of? The hinderer. He's like, nah. I don't think they're worthy. God's saying, hey. Are you the judge? Well, what's he calling them to do? Go point out their sin and bring people to God. Again, go point out their sin and bring people to God. We're not called to be the judge, but we are called to point out sin, bring people to God. There's a good way and a bad way to do that. I hope by now most of us know the good way and the bad way to do it. We're not just supposed to be swacking people over the head with the Bible, right? But we see these instances of people who aren't team players. And then let's look at a depiction of Christ's life. This guy's just serving. He's not holding back. The one guy who has a right to say, nah, he's not holding back. He's calling people to a high standard and letting the people go, nah. But the one guy who had a right to judge is coming in and saying, come on, come on. If we are holding somebody back, that is a heart from these stories is mind-blowing and hard to achieve, hard to obtain. But I hope that's a higher calling for us to start working on our hearts. I hope that's a higher calling when we start to realize that, hey, when we get in that mindset of the perspective of, nah, we still sow the seed. That's patience, that's peace, that's understanding beyond what anybody on earth without a godly perspective is ever going to understand. Because in this moment, David's got every legal right with where we're, like, even today, the hold your ground laws. I mean, he's got, back then, today, every legal right, everybody would understand. What does he choose to do? Sow seed. To a guy who's already anointed by God, what does he say? Hey, God's given you into my hand. Hey, we're going to let God judge between us. Hey, we're going to let God settle this dispute. Well, when we do more than that, we're taking it out of God's hands. What are we supposed to be doing? Giving it all back to Him. Every situation we run into, every opportunity that we have, we're supposed to be giving it back to God. Not taking it upon Hunter's self to hold somebody back that he has a squirmish with or doesn't think deserves it. Or that's when I'm going to say, hey, we're not the judge. But we are supposed to sow the seed. One more thing. It kind of falls in, kind of not, but I think it's my brother told me one of the most incredible things this past week. I was dealing with some frustrations, some anxieties, and I want to challenge y'all as we go out today, and I think this has to do with David's heart issue. You see him in a circumstance that's not pleasant nor pleasing, and anybody would want out of, and he still chooses the right thing. Kyle asked me the other day, and it was super odd, weird, never heard it before, so I want to ask y'all. At the end of the day, can you go home and say, did God have a good day? Has anybody ever asked you that? Has anybody ever thought of that? Hey, did God have a good day in Hunter's life? Hey, did God have a good day in Chloe's life? Did God have a good day? Because what do you do when you ask that? What do you do when you ask if you ask somebody if God had a good day? Take circumstance out, right? Hey, did you exemplify God? Did you exemplify the characteristics of God? Were you good reflection? Did you take the opportunities that you had to sow seed? Hey, was this a good day for God's kingdom? When he asked me that, I go, well, this has nothing to do with my life. Right? Isn't that ridiculous that I was so caught up in what was going on around me that I started to get stressed out and anxious? And I started to worry, and things started to bear down on me. And he goes, well, how was God's day? You're like, well, I guess I didn't do too good in that either. Right? Because I was so focused on what was going on with me and what was going on around me that I completely missed the whole point. Which, did I work for God's kingdom today, or did I work for Hunter today? David could have worked for David that day, and nobody would have blamed him. Instead, David got to go to sleep with the peace and understanding that he worked for God that day. I hope at the end of the day, spouses, brothers, I hope when y'all sit around the dinner table, I hope the question starts to become, how was God's day today? Because when you ask that, the cruddiness of life kind of doesn't seem so big. The cruddiness of life kind of dissipates because you're like, well, yeah, this happened, but that provided me an opportunity to sow seeds, so yeah, I guess God had a pretty good day. Because whether you're successful or whether you end up broke, if you're doing what God has planned for you, the outcome of your life is perfect. If we're getting caught up in all the garbage that we look around, I didn't really get all that I needed to get done today. I get a chuckle out of my mom every once in a while because she is a very scheduled person down to the wire. And I used to ask her, or not in the best way, I'll admit, when something would be going on, I'd be like, well, isn't it God's time? Right? I know you got your schedule, but isn't it God's time? That was out of being argumentative at the time. But looking back, it is God's time. So when we come into contact with somebody else, somebody that we haven't met or have met, are we using that time to reflect God? You might have somebody that irritates the absolute hound out of you. Can you deal that with that situation and that person with grace and reflect God so that maybe they get an opportunity to come into relationship with Him? Can you sow the seed so that maybe they have a chance? Can you sow the seed so that people start to look towards God? Can you do all these things and look back at the end of the day and go, yep, God had a good day? Because whether you're employed or an employer, the upper story is you work for God. So if I'm sitting down in the most frustrating situation at work and things aren't going well, what's my obligation and my duty? Not necessarily to look at the, hey, this is the best way to make money for our world. This is the best way to make. This is the best way to take. This is the best way to... No. What's my duty and my obligation? Hey, this is how God has called me to treat people. This is how God has called me to take care of people. This is how God has called me to run business. And if I'm doing those things, the end of the day outcome's all up to God. You're not going to force that. So at the end of the day, if we don't sell anything, what should I still be saying? Thank you, Lord, for the opportunity to share you. Sow your seed to work for you. And I know I'm not perfect, but I'm working towards it. I'm working towards good days for the kingdom. I went over again. Man, one day. Before, that's my New Year's resolution.
Thank y'all for being here.
2028. Next year. Thank y'all.
Just take me.